Huge performances, strong crowds, and plenty of controversial decisions. Royal Ascot had it all. This is the front page. That's right, 5 days of brilliant action for us to get stuck into here on the Royal Ascot 2026 review. A brilliant week at the Royal Meeting. Plenty of superstars on show, plenty of big stories as well. My name's Sam Hart, trying to steer you through all the action that took place alongside in the studio Lewis Porteous. Welcome, Lewis. And at home, we have Mr. Graham Robway from the betting team, who can give some great insight in some of the big performances that happened. But before we get into Royal Ascot, just before we started recording, Keir Starmer has resigned as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Andy Burnham is around 25-1 on to be his successor. It seems like that's very likely now. There's going to be plenty of action across racingpost.com over the coming days. But Lewis, just a quick word on what this could mean for the sport.
I mean, Andy Burnham looks odds, long odds on, as you say, to get the position. He was born in Aintree, which is probably quite positive for the sport. He's a huge general sports fan. However, I'd say his stance with... He has been vocal on anti-gambling in the past policy. He discussed gambling as a public health issue. Probably as strong as anyone who's been in number 10... his views on anti-gambling, so which isn't probably that positive for racing and the gambling industries combined. However, if you're new to a prime ministerial job, it's probably not something that's going to be top of your priorities. It's going to probably fall a long way down. So we'll have to see, Sam, and there'll probably be a shake-up in his cabinet, obviously, as well, different positions. So I can't imagine... gambling reform and anti-gambling campaigning would be at the top of his agenda, but it's something definitely to keep a close eye on. He has supported gambling shops in the past and the people who work in betting shops through the pandemic. So there's two sides of it, but in general, he has sort of taken an anti-gambling stance in the past.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting, and do, like I say, keep your eyes on racepost.com for all of the big news that comes out of that, and it will just spread across the coming days. Right, let's get stuck into what, like I say, was a brilliant week at Ascot last week, and we're going to start off with the performance on day one. The big race and the big showdown was between Boeco, Gustard and Talk of New York, and it was Boeco who came out on top in the St. James's Palace. It was a performance where you thought he was going to win by many lengths at one stage, but in the end he didn't find too much off the bridle, and Gustard battled as hard as possible, but Boeco did find his way to come out on top. Graham Robway, it was a really, really good race. I mean, there was one stage, like I say, I thought there was going to be a couple of lengths between them, but Gustard, what a fighter, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the mile division over the next couple of months.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? It was not as good as it looked like it was going to be 2 furlongs down, Sam. I thought 2 furlongs down, we were going to see another demolition job like we got at Newmarket. Didn't quite end up like that. He was all out at the finish, wasn't he? And Gustard really pushed him right to the line. There's a few people saying maybe the horse isn't the biggest and he won't progress. But nevertheless, he's doing the job, isn't he? He's still unbeaten. He's still putting up the ones on the board. And until Gustard actually goes and beat him, I'm not going to be a believer in the fact that Boeco's on his way down. I can't wait to see him go again. Probably at Goodwood, would you say, Sam, for the Sussex now?
Yeah, you'd love to see him at Goodwood. It'd be interesting to see if that's the way he goes. And we did have a piece online, Lewis, about the next Franco. I know we do this all the time. Yeah. We did it with Baid, was probably the last horse we did this for. But Boeco, he's a very small horse. You can tell that during a race, how small he is compared to someone like Gustard, who's a big bully of a horse who probably is going to go to somewhere like America at the end of the season and perform really, really well. Is he the superstar, or would you say that Gustard, potentially, if they went up again, will actually go and beat him?
I mean, will Gustard ever get a better chance than that Tuesday, the way it was run and things like that? You could tell the size difference when they came out the stalls. He was a meet between the sandwich of Gustard and Talk of New York, two horses that are considerably bigger than him. But I wouldn't necessarily call him tiny by any means. He's near on 16 hands. He just looked small in comparison, but I thought everything went wrong and he still won. I like horses who find a way to win, even in adversity. Is he the next Frankel? No, he isn't, but it's unfair to tar any horse with that brush. I sort of agree with Graham. He gets the job done, whether it's flashy in the guineas or All Out there. I think Goodwood would really suit him. Favours a lot of pace. I think a stiff mile like on Tuesday was as far as he wants to go. I'd have him to Frank the Form if they met at Goodwood.
Okay, and talking of Gustard, team tactics came into play. There was plenty said about that across the week. Puerto Rico coming off the bend, pushing out, letting Gustard up that inside rail. Christophe Soumillon received an 8-day ban, which he is going to be appealing against. Was it fair?
I mean, in my eyes, it was certainly fair. I mean, Aidan came out and said, look, every horse is run on its own merits, and that's absolutely fine. But if that was the case, there was no need for him to be looking repeatedly over his shoulder to the inside. I thought that was quite telling. And going back and watching previous St. James's Palace stakes, they usually glue to that inside rail, and they were a hell of a long way off it. Boeco went very wide as a result, and it did open up like the Red Sea for Gustard. So I thought the stewards made a tough decision, but the right decision. Could it have arguably been more than 8 days? Perhaps. It'll be interesting what happens in the appeal, because it's just how you go about proving this. Yeah. I do not know, because obviously Aidan's already said there was no instructions to come off the rail or anything like that. And if Christophe is surely going to follow the same line of questioning, the line of reasoning, it's going to be tough. But to me, the repeated looks over his shoulder looked like he was looking for Gustard.
Yeah, a little bit questionable, wasn't it? Other performances on the Tuesday. Graham, I'm going to come to you, because you, on the Royal Ascot preview show that we did prior to the meeting, had a good time with the big sprints, the 5 furlong, 6 furlong sprint. Mission Central took that out for Aidan O'Brien and Ryan Moore. Really impressive. You bet a big price in that race.
It was surprisingly big price, wasn't he, Mission Central? I was very, very surprised that he was double figure odds, given he was the Ryan Moore and Aidan O'Brien pick of the Ryan Moore, Ryan Moore's pick of the Aidan O'Brien horses, even, Sam. So yeah, I was very, very surprised that he was such a big price, but I thought that he won the race well, did well to get up near the line.
Yeah, I thought Ryavka was extremely unlucky for the Graffard team. I thought that horse probably should have gone and won. Big shock in the opener as well, the Queen Anne Stakes, 50-1, 10 Bob Tony. Who would have thought that?
Probably reflective of the wider mile in division a little bit. They can beat each other, but credit where credit's due. He came out quickly after a run on sort of pretty horrendous ground at Epsom and turned up and got the job done. But it's a puzzler, that mile division.
Okay, and then the Coventry Stakes as well. That's the only other big race you should mention. Great Barrier Reef. Now the Antipost 14-1 shot for the 2,000 guineas. What did you make of that performance?
We'll probably get onto the drawbacks, but he was maybe furthest away from the near side rail, you maybe mark it up a little bit. He was tough, he was tenacious. They were all quite bunch behind.
Okay. Graham, I don't know whether we'll probably discuss it towards the end, but were there any two-year-olds across the week that you were quite impressed with, potentially sort of the classics in mind for next year?
Well, I think Orthodox was very impressive, wasn't he, on the last, or she, on the last day. I'm not sure if it is a he, very, very impressive, Orthodox. And the filly on Friday, that was definitely a filly, won the Albany
call.
Libertango. Yeah, she was really good, weren't she? You know, they were the two standout performances from the juveniles for me, Sam, over the week. Libertango and Orthodox over the last 2 days. Just on Tuesday, I thought Map of Stars was really, really good. I thought he travelled like a class horse, Map of Stars. And he's had chances in top grades before and disappointed, not quite fulfilled his potential. I think the trainer said that he has this habit of running the odd really bad race, but when he's on his game, when it's his day, Sam, he's a very good horse, and he showed that on Tuesday. And you know what, I wouldn't be surprised if Map of Stars manages to plunder Group One before the end of the season, judging by how easily he won that on Tuesday.
Well, okay, and James McDonald took the ride on Map of Stars, and he had some week as well, didn't he? Let's move on to the Wednesday then, and possibly the star performance of the week in the Prince of Wales' Stakes. It was Ombudsman who came out on top over Deriz in that battle that we were all matching up over the last 2 weeks. Pacemaker was in there, Lewis. Plenty has been said by Gosden about pacemakers, which was interesting considering he used one to win the race. But Ombudsman, like I say, he was possibly one of the stars of the week.
Yeah, two pacemakers in there, weren't they, from different camps. I think Fast Ground 10 furlongs at Ascot. He's near on unbeatable, this horse. Yeah, it was a joy to behold, really. Such a sizzling turn of foot. Exceptional animal when he gets his conditions.
He really is. And Graham, it was interesting because there is his price for the Arc. We know he's won two races prior to coming to Ascot, but his price for the Arc hasn't moved at all. He's around 7-2, 4-1 still for the Arc de Triomphe later in the season. Are you still a big believer that there is the one to beat over maybe a mile and a half?
Yeah, I think there is still a very, very high class individual, no doubt about that. The ground didn't quite come in his favour on Wednesday, and I think he came up against an absolutely top draw performance from Ombudsman, who clearly is at his best around Ascot. A really fast run race on quick ground suits him. What was most impressive about Ombudsman was his closing sectionals were absolutely rapid. Mm. He was sub 24 seconds for the last two furlongs anyway. Really, really fast final section, much quicker than anything else on the card. And when you consider that they really went hard throughout that race, to be able to finish off a race in fast sectionals after going so quickly throughout the whole of the race tells you just how good Ombudsman must be on his day. I'd be worried about him back at Sandown, Sam. Mm. To me, I've seen him there a couple of times, Sandown, if he goes to the Eclipse. You know, he was beaten in the Eclipse last year, wasn't he? I know that he beat Geffen. You've given him £7, but I wasn't blown away by him at Sandown. I think this was the absolute peak Ombudsman. I'm not sure you're going to see it again this season. You didn't see it again last season. That was a point I was making on the show on Wednesday morning, was that maybe Ombudsman had peaked already. I was wrong, obviously, but I do think that the Prince of Wales Stakes, we've seen him twice now turn up at Ascot, quick ground, and look outstanding, and then look, all right, a good horse away from Ascot, but not quite the same. So while I think it was the performance of the week, and I was blown away by how quickly he finished and how good he was, going forward, I do think that there's other horses who can win Group 1s ahead of him.
Yeah, he's around even money for the Eclipse currently, and it does come quite quick. We're only a couple of weeks away, and I'd possibly say the Gosdens might be in favour of just waiting for York.
John Gosden definitely gave himself room to manoeuvre for not running at Sandown. He sort of offered that himself. He also ran in Dubai this season that he didn't the year before, so there's another run as well there. So we'll see how the horse is, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if they do sort of swerve that this year, because he had to sort of go and push his own pace last season. That didn't help. He's so good. He can quicken off a quick pace. That's what makes him exceptional. I just think trying to make your own running and then quicken off it, he finds it harder. But so I wouldn't be surprised if he actually doesn't turn up at Sandown. I was quite impressed with Minnie Hawk as well. Mm. I like the way Darrier's sort of eyeballed her, and she was like, not this time, sunshine. Quite sweet on her for the Arc, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because Tom Siegel, at the end of last season, the tipping team do it, they do kind of an anti-post bet for the following year. Tom Siegel put a 50-1, the reverse forecast, on Darrier to beat Minnie Hawk. And I actually, now looking at it, I don't actually mind it at all. I think that could actually be the case.
Both look like strong half horses, don't they? Both ran well in defeat. I could see her turning it around, to be honest.
We'll be intrigued to see. The other performance that I did like on day two was Victorious. I thought she was mightily impressive, and talk about draw, she won her side. But the Wesley Ward horse on the near side was Reaver, who finished Reaver third, who ran a really big race. And I spoke to Wesley midweek, and he eyed up potentially the Nunthorpe with her, which is, you know, a two-year-old filly going into a race like that. You know how much weight they get. He knows how to run a decent horse in a Nunthorpe. So it was I think it was a good race.
I was just looking at the RPRs before we came in here. Orthodox and Victorious were top two-year-olds with 109 RPRs. It was a good race. Wesley liked Nunthorpe for Reaver. He also liked it for Baccio. Mm-hmm. He was saying, who actually clocked a faster time than the King Charles III winner when winning that Palace of Holyrood rate in the league. I thought there was some good two-year-old performance. Victorious, I thought... she's got a lot of stamina on the damn side, yet she won over five. Like, she could be a bit of a freak, you know, winning over five. She'd get seven, no problem, this season. So between five and seven and maybe even a mile next season. She's very smart, very uncomplicated, lovely way about her.
With her pace, I can imagine the Milan division would be certainly right up her street moving towards the back end of the season. Now, on to day three then, and now this Scandinavia winning the Gold Cup. This, for me, was one of the best races I've ever seen live. It was just superb. These staying races, Lewis, they always throw up these thrilling finishes. I was trying to think back, and 2017, Order of St. George versus Big Orange was one. I remember the Goodwood Cup being there to see Kyprios, Stradivarius and Trushan turning together in that race. And the noise and what it brings is incredible. But Scandinavia, coming off that bend, off the bridle, there was not a stage where I didn't think Ryan's going to go and get this.
Really?
Yeah. Did you think Trollhättan would hold on?
There was just time. Yeah, they leveled up and he didn't get to him straight away, and I just thought the old horse might just keep finding a bit here. I think more mastery all week was evident.
So good
at getting him going without his stick, you know, rowing them along, and then only asking when he really went for him. The horse was there. He seems to know exactly what he's got underneath him. It was just a rousing race, wasn't it? Had everything. The staying division has gone through like a rebirth. It went through a lot of a lean time. We should thank Ballydoyle for what they brought to that division. Some awesome horses. But it takes two to tango, and Trollhättan lost little in defeat on his first run of the season. I can't wait to see a rematch.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, Aidan outlined the Goodwood Cup, which is obvious. He's already won one Goodwood Cup already with Scandinavia. G-Rod, we mentioned how lazy Scandinavia can be on our Royal Ascot preview and that he'll only do it as far as he needs to go and do it. Is that the making of a champion stayer? Do you see him turning up at Ascot, becoming one of those 3-4-time, you know, cup winners in some of these races?
Yeah, he definitely could be, Sam. I do the racing post ratings for the staying division. I gave him a 123 RPR, which is incidentally exactly the same racing post rating that Trollhättan got when he won last year by a longer margin. I actually rated Scandinavia a 2-length winner, even though he won by a much shorter margin, because I think that he had a more troubled run around the track. I think he was value for further than the margin. As you keep saying, he's a sort of horse who only just does enough. So yeah, you're also never going to get to the bottom of that sort of horse. He's a bit like Kyprios. Kyprios on his day was capable of monstrous performances, but he always tended just to do just enough. And that's a mark of the top stayers. I would say that I don't think Trollhättan ran right up to his best here. I gave him 121. He's £2 below his best. I thought John Gosden was quick to point out after the race, let's not forget that he's had this, you know, weird eye problem where he has to wear sunglasses, and he's not really been able to train him quite in the same way that he did last year. He didn't get the prep run into him, and he expects Trollhättan will improve significantly for the run. So if Trollhättan does come on for the run, could be a cracking rematch between them wherever they turn up next, Sam, couldn't it?
Yeah, it certainly could. I mean, Harry Wilson was just talking to me in the office, and he said, do you think if Trollhättan had a run, Scandinavia would still have got there? And my answer was, yeah, I just think he'll just... Like, we were joking in the house as well during the week that David Jennings, if he ran against Scandinavia, he'd still only win by half a length, because he just wants to do it just by as far as he wants. I think he's just a very clever horse.
Yeah, I think that is why you get the longevity out of these horses, because they maybe don't. They just do it the absolute minimum or just enough. Not ungenuine, though, is he? Because when he does ask him, he'll answer, but he'll... Yeah, he's just not going to do it without being asked. You're probably right, you know. He might just always come out on top by a short margin, but there's got to be a reason to think that Trollhättan will take a step forward for his first run of the season.
OK, we'll have to wait and see. The other performance, just a quick mention, was Blue Bolt in the Duke of Cambridge Stakes. There's a potential of the Falmouth for her. Maybe they could, I mean, she's had a run at Goodwood already, maybe they could step her up and go for the Nassau. We'll have to wait and see. It's going to be an interesting race if they do turn up at the Nassau, because Aidan's got some top fillies over that distance. But yeah, she looked really good.
Lovely profile, like 5 wins just from 8 starts. Already run up in a Group 1 Sun Chariot last year. I'd say the foul. She'll definitely win a Group 1 against her own sex.
Yeah.
And in an open mile division, it'd be nice to see her pitching against the boys at some stage. But she kind of looked like a Falmouth winner in waiting to me.
Yeah, that's what I thought, certainly. So there we go, that is all for day three. Before we get stuck into the final 2 days, I want to give a quick mention to our new Racing Influencers series. We've got some nice pieces online and in the paper, but some brilliant video to support it as well. And the first person on our list is the excellent Sir Mark Prescott. And here's a quick clip of what they've been up to.
If I ask you about the importance of turning up on time and It's everything, isn't it?
So, but, I mean, you have always begun work at the same time, I think, every day. Yeah. For how long?
Since I started training.
What time is that?
I'm always up by 3:30, and I'm normally up by 3.
And in terms of staff coming in here,
they can start whenever they like.
As long
whenever as. They like, they can start absolutely fine by me. But if they're not ready to pull out at 6:15 or 6:30, they're dead. So it's as simple as that, you know. I don't care when they start. But they've got to be ready on time.
Yes, some brilliant stuff from Sir Mark there, and there'll be plenty more video to come as well. Do keep an eye on the Racing Post social platforms and YouTube channel for more. So into day 4 of the Royal Meeting, and the first race we'll talk about is the Commonwealth Cup, which was won by Venetian Sun. She did go off short. A few people wanted to take her on, but she proved why. She's just very, very good. Lewis, this was a real fair, decent performance. Backed up that win at Haydock really well.
Yeah, it probably showed another side to her. Tenacious, tough. She was sort of breathtaking at Haydock. Might not been her absolute best. And I think the team were a little concerned about the ground, and she might be a little bit better with a bit of juice. But I think it was one of them where she got the job done. Interesting. Again, draw-wise, her and Spicy Marg were right over, so a good horse could win from that side. But it was a tenacious performance. I think she's arguably maybe even a little bit better than what she showed.
Okay, yeah. Graham, how did you rate the Commonwealth Cup this year?
I actually don't know what to make of this horse now, Venetian Sun. I saw her at Haydock, and I thought she's not as good as that. And then she still won on Friday, and I came out of the race thinking she's still not as good as I thought she is, but she's won, if you know what I mean. Let's not forget that Spicy Marg was a 50-1 outsider who didn't really have any right to get anywhere near her. Maybe that Lewis is bang on that she wasn't quite at her best that day. I do feel that this is a horse who's not as good as she looks. Like, she travels like an absolute express train, but in a lot of these races, and I said this on our morning show on Thursday, in a lot of these races the horses tend to be coming back on her. It's not like she's having to quicken to win these races. Like, she's going past horses who are stopping, I guarantee you that. But nevertheless, she keeps doing it. She keeps sticking those ones on the board. She did beat Gastard last year. She had form with Precise. So she's a very, very hard horse to knock, Sam. But as a punter and tipster, you know, my job is to find reasons to get these horses that are going to go off short prices beaten all the time. And I do remain convinced that this Venetian Sun is a horse that I'm going to get beaten at a very short price at some point this year. So I can't wait to take her on wherever she turns up next time. But she does keep winning.
Okay, yeah, she's interesting. The other horse that is certainly interesting is Precise, who ran against True Love once again. This time Precise 2-1 up for the season on True Love. But there was a little bit of controversy as well with regards to Tulene's run into the race. A lot of people saying that Tulene should have won this race, and essentially they were right watching the replays, True Love holding her in. But we were speaking off air, but Wayne Lorden just held his line, didn't he?
I thought so. He came round in that lane and he stayed in that lane. Any jockey worth the salt would have surely, you know, closed the door. I didn't think he lent in. He just kept it in his lane. But we were talking about size of horses earlier. Like, True Love is twice the size of Tulene. And she was just like, there's no way you're coming through here. It was unfortunate. Like, and you would be frustrated if you were either back to lean or you rode to lean or you had anything to do with it, because she was flying at the end, and with a clear run it would have been interesting. But he stayed within the rules. It was just canny race riding from Lorden, in my opinion.
Okay. And Precise, the winner, again, I've already mentioned the last stakes, that's probably just being a Goodwood fan myself, but Aidan's now got Precise and Diamond Necklace, who are the potentials for that race. It'd be interesting to see what he does and how he splits those two.
Yeah, she was, again, a bit like Venetian. Maybe it wasn't Precise at a peak, but she was in front a long way out at Ascot. It's not easy, and she just kept finding. She's a strong stayer at that mile. I like strong stayers at the trip. She ground it out, and even if with a clear run, like maybe if Tulene had eyeballed, she'd have found more. She's that sort of filly, real, really likeable.
Yeah, I'll put you on the spot, Mr. Robway. Precise or Diamond Necklace, which one of the fillies is better?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, Sam, because I'm not convinced that either's that good. But we're going to find out, I guess. Precise is a real grinder. They weren't finishing that quickly in that race in the Coronation Stakes. Tulin was closing on her because, again, they were all slowing down, not really quickening up. But Precise stays really strongly. I don't think Tulin would have got past her personally. I don't think Tulin was unlucky. I think Precise would have had her measure no matter how the race was run. Diamond Necklace, again, she's a horse who keeps winning, but I keep looking at her thinking everyone thinks she's something special. I'm not convinced she is. Precise, maybe. I don't know. I don't like either of them, Sam. Going to be taking them both on as we go on through the season for sure.
Well, there you go then. Big calls from Graham Robway. Who would have thought that? The other big talking point on day four was just incredible, was Bashio. I think I pronounced that right, in the Palace of Holyrood House for Wesley Ward. I think even after the meat and cheese platters I had all week, I think I could have ridden that horse to win. It was such an impressive performance. We were in the media marquee kind of going, oh, wow, that was incredible, that was amazing. And then suddenly you hear the bing bong go off. I'm like, what could this be for? Like, there was no interference, just won as easy as she liked. And then suddenly we hear the jockeys weighed in light by a pound. Tell us a bit more on the story of this, Lewis.
Well, it's crazy, wasn't it? I mean, firstly, like, how quick that horse was into stride early on. Wasn't it? It's not actually the gait. It's that first sort of 50 yards afterwards. The feet are so fast. He was into stride like Wes Ward's horses were all week. It's completely dominant. And then apparently the overgirth, which just is a strap that goes round the girth for extra protection, flew off in the melee, in the winner's enclosure afterwards, and the Mexican rider weighed in light, and then all panic broke out. I mean, I would say, like, I've been in my job 20 years, and I must have been at the races half a dozen times when a jockey is weighed in light, and I've never known a jockey get the chance to present at the scales twice. However, I do think we knock the sport, the BHA, the stewards for, you know, not letting common sense prevail. And to be honest, the camera shows that he wore it during the race. The camera shows it coming off in the parade ring. I think common sense has prevailed ultimately. It's just unusual that they got a second chance to weigh in. But you can't really knock that performance, can you?
Yeah, Juan Hernandez with a brilliant ride on these Wesley Ward horses. As I say, they just ping out and go, don't they? I have to say, and you mentioned the BHA, that I have to give them so much praise. They came out on Sky, and the explanation of what happened was actually brilliant.
Sean Parker, who's the head of the stewarding, he is generally very good at that. He doesn't go missing in the big moments. He didn't want to talk about the one earlier in the week on the Tuesday, and the question mark there was why it took so long for that. That's the only missing answer really from the week. Why did the Gestad and Puerto Rico inquiry take so long to play out? But no, fair play. He came out, said that your guy weighed in 2 pounds light, and they found the overgirth, and which got him to within a pound of the weight which they're allowed. So I think the right result was ultimately reached, but it is very unusual for a jockey to get to sit on those scales twice.
Yeah, it was just fascinating. It really was, and how the story.
Sam, the bigger question I think is to what extent should this horse have been allowed to run in this race in the first place, and how accurately could you expect a handicapper to be able to handicap a horse like that going into a handicap, if you know what I mean? Now, we're quite strict over here about horses having to have two or three runs so that the handicapper can get an idea of what their level is. Now, I know that Bachio had three or four runs in America, but you can't tell me. I've got no idea who handicapped this horse, and I've got a lot of friends who are BHA handicappers, obviously, and I don't want to upset them. But if you put this to me and said, Graham, can you please tell me what handicap Mark Bachio should be running in the Palace of Holyrood House based on three runs in Churchill Downs? I mean, I could have, you know, I'd be guessing. I'd be totally guessing. I could give you 90, I could give you 110. It's anyone's guess. I know that we want to attract these great American international runners to Royal Ascot, and it's great to have them there. But do we want them running in handicaps like this when this horse is clearly a group horse? He might even be a group one horse. We've given him a racing post rating of 117, Sam, which is exactly the same racing post rating as Venetian Sun got for winning the Commonwealth Cup. So we're guilty here of letting a group one horse into a handicap off a mark of 100. I'm not blaming anyone. It's a very difficult horse to handicap. It's not the handicapper's fault. But the point is should a potential genuine group one horse be coming over from a different country like America, where we cannot possibly have any idea how good the shrink for that form is, because the horse is impossible to give a proper mark to. And as a result, let's be honest, he made a mockery of that race. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was one of the low points of the week, was watching that race.
Do you think Wesley knew then, Graham, as soon as that handicap mark came out, say, oh, we'll ignore all the group race that we could potentially go for, let's go for this one here? And then we saw the horse. I can't remember what the opening show, I want to say just around 10 to 1, but ended up shortening up to around 5 to 2 at one stage. Do you think they just knew?
Well, it seems the market thought that he was evidently well underestimated by his handicap mark, which he was. And it just, to me, raises the question of, is it fair on the British horses and the Irish horses, who the handicapper just genuinely knows more about, is it fair that you should have a horse so lightly raced coming over from a jurisdiction that no handicapper can have a real handle on how good that level is, running in a handicap like that? And when they go and win it in that way, it was so uncompetitive. I mean, the last furlong, I was like, oh, how has this happened? This is a nightmare. What a disaster. As a punter, because punters, you know, unless you're following the money or following the talk, punters love to solve the puzzle. They want to read the form, they want to look at the form. And a horse like Baccio, you cannot possibly give him a chance as a punter, because I don't know how good he is. You don't know how good he is. The BHA handicappers had no idea how good he was. They were guessing at his mark. They got it wrong. I don't blame them. It's not their fault. He was a very hard horse to handicap. But should that be allowed in that race? I don't think so.
In agreement?
It's a good point. Like, if you were one of those trainers or connections in that race, like, you've got to feel a little bit aggrieved, haven't you? You can't blame the trainer, Ward, though. He can ask for a figure. He's got one. I'll play my hand. Yeah. And he wasn't shy about it all week that he was saying this is probably in the, you know, in the right race for that horse to do something like that. But, like, to be honest, I agree with Graham. It's like, it did sort of make a mockery of that race to that extent. Personally, I quite enjoyed the sight of him blitzing away. And he spoke the next day, Wes, of like the Nunthorpe. That's the sort of horse we're talking about here. But God, you'd feel aggrieved if you ran into that.
It was a real performance, that was, but plenty of drama behind it as well. Let us know in the comments what you made of it, or do you think the horse, you know, should have been disqualified, or are you happy letting this horse run? What did you make of the handicap marks? Just let us know down below. We'll read as many comments as possible. Now on to the final day then, and we'll start off with the big sprint, the Queen Elizabeth II Jubilee Stakes, apologies, that was won by Almeric, who beat the international raiders Zatano Rev and Jolly Star, who it was a hell of a thrilling finish. Graham Robway, a lot of horses tried to do the double of winning the 5 furlong sprint on the Tuesday and then winning it on the Saturday, but you're a man who ended up tipping up the winner of the 5 furlong sprint and the 6 furlong sprint on the Royal Ascot Preview Show. I haven't actually worked out what the double paid yet.
No, I enjoyed this one particularly, Sam, as you can tell. You know, when we did our Royal Ascot preview show, you, me and Johnny Pearson the week before Ascot, I did say to you that I had no idea how good the foreign horses were. But then it came down to price on the British horses, and at 33.40 to 1, Almeric had to be of interest. I think he ended up going off 25s. It's very unusual to get a horse trained by William Haggis, ridden by Tom Markund, who had won the vast majority of his starts, 3 of his 6 starts, fallen on one of them, finished second on a couple of others. Very, very lightly raced. You had no idea how good he was. And very, very unusual to get a price like 25 to 1 on a horse with those sorts of connections, with that sort of profile. But that is where the upside of having these foreign sprinters over can work in a British favour if you just want to stick with a British form. Because obviously the market was totally taken up by Jolly Star and Satono Rev, and they ran fantastic races. They ran their hearts out. But wasn't it great? Everyone slags the British sprinter. The British sprinters are rubbish. None of them are any good. Oh, we can bring our second, third string over and the Aussies will beat them easily. Well, no, you can't, because Almirak's comfortably beaten Satono Rev. He's beaten Jolly Star. Now let's take it to those Aussies. Come on, the British.
I think, oh, that's strong words again. But 400-1 double, close to 400-1 double from Graham Robway on the Royal Ascot preview show in the two sprints. He said comfortably. Satono Rev and Jolly Star were all in that photo finish with Almirak. I thought Satono Rev was extremely unlucky for Japan. And obviously the Kai Ying rising form is all in there. We'd still love to see him come over to Royal Ascot and show what he can do. It will never happen, I would say, but it was a hell of a finish.
It was kind of only Ascot, wasn't it? A Brit, yeah. a Japanese, an Aussie, and then a French on the near side.
Sounded like a joke, didn't it?
it was a good look. It was great. It was international challenges all lining up. And I agree with Graham. Like, it's a blow. It's a blow landed for the British sprinters that continually get ridiculed. So it was a good result. It's incredible that Japan's domination around the world, and they still haven't had a winner at Royal Ascot. And like, that also has come twice now, Satono Rev. To be honest, he looked the first beat, and Ryan again sort of invigorated him, and he got swamped by one coming over the top of him. But it was, I think it encapsulated Ascot for me, that race. You know, all the different nations all fighting it out. It was a good spectacle.
Yeah, it really was. And the other performance that's worth noting is Kalpana was beaten by Gia Velotto, Oshi Murphy, beating the balding horse, which has probably been an interesting morning this morning in the yard, I'd imagine. But Gia Velotto, it's incredible, his story, because his debut win was 100-1 when he first ever started. And he's just gone round the world winning these races, and now Royal Ascot to his CV as well. An incredible horse.
That beat two good horses in Carpon and Goliath, didn't he? Good horse when he gets his conditions. He's done it in Hong Kong on rattling fast ground before, and obviously that's his bag. I do think Kalpana sat on a big performance, maybe when she gets some juice in the ground. I rate her highly. They said the King George would be next, maybe a rematch with Goliath, there'll be Calandagan. So the King George is shaping up nicely, but Gia Velotto were tough. Would Colin Keane maybe wait a fraction longer if he had his time again on Kalpana, probably, but like I say, I think a mile and a half, when she gets some juice, she could produce something pretty tasty.
Yeah, I don't think they'll go arc at the end of the season, but you can see her turning back up at Ascot on Champions Day on softer conditions at around 5-4.
Yeah, against her own sex, she's hard to beat.
Yeah, 100%, she really is. Other big stories of the week, then, just generic stories. Aidan O'Brien versus Joseph O'Brien. This was just incredible. And Tom Siegel had some strong words at the start of the week on our morning show, saying that he thinks Joseph could end up being better than Aidan, which are obviously big words, because Aidan is, you know, the GOAT of the training ranks on the flat sphere. I was really impressed with how Joseph, what he does with what he has in these races. And he obviously has plenty of runners in them, but he's just so clever in placing these horses.
Yeah, so let's put it in perspective. Like, Aidan had 7 winners, 3 Group 1s, 3 Group 2s. Joseph had 5, 3 of which were in handicaps.
Yeah.
Queen's Bar's a group race and a listed. So they're not like for like here. Joseph's classic quality of horse isn't anything like his dad's. But like you say, a lot of these horses are sourced from public sales, and they doesn't actually spend ridiculous amounts. He's obviously got a good team source in them, and he's taking on the big owner breeders with horses bought at public sales, which is a feat in itself. He knows what he's got. He runs them in the right races. He sent a huge team, but he got the results. And I just think when you do something like that on a stage like that, it does attract more attention, and those owner breeders that maybe have been lacking in the past are probably going to be queuing up now. Judmont's already joined the bandwagon, I'm sure will. So what you will expect is he will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And he's also got the Oaks winner, Thundering On, who could literally be anything.
What's going to be interesting is his jockey, Dylan Brown McMonagall, who is a sensational rider. Obviously, we're talking plenty about him after the win at Epsom. I mean, he's with a yard that are going to have plenty of winners and they're going to get better and better, like you say, but he's probably the favourite in my head to take Ryan Moore's position as the leading rider at Ballydoor. But would he want that role at this stage, like with what Joseph could end up having?
I don't think Ryan's anywhere close to ending. So we've had this before where, Colin Keane's going to get that job, and then Ryan comes out and, he could. I mean, how long could Ryan go for? He looks after himself. He could go for quite a bit, I should think. So, I don't know if that time comes, like Dylan's name would obviously be in the shake-up, but Joseph might be in a different position in his career then. Who knows? But I think Joseph's sort of heir to the throne, of his dad's throne. But again, I don't think we're anywhere near the end of Aidan or Ryan, and they're still the dominant force.
If anything, we're still getting to the best of it. I thought it was a sensational week from both of them. And talking about Aidan O'Brien, G-Rod, 100 winners at Royal Ascot. He hit that mark and it was a magnificent feat. And I'd imagine you've seen a fair few horses of Aidan's run at Royal Ascot. Have there been any favourites for yourself?
Oh, yeah. Amazing achievement, isn't it, to reach 100 winners at Royal Ascot. And Ryan Moore's on 99, of course, now, isn't he? You could reel them off down the years, couldn't you? You know, greats like Giant's Causeway winning the St. James's Palace. I'll never forget the Iron Horse, the ultimate Aidan O'Brien horse. So many great Aidan O'Brien horses. A trademark of them is just how tough they are. We've seen them this week, Scandinavia, Precise, when the real... when they really go for them, when Ryan really goes for them, they really come and find for him. And Giant's Causeway was the ultimate example of that, when ridden by Mick Cannan, of course, at the time. But that would be a standout for me. Obviously, he had great stayers like Yates and Kiprios, but Giant's Causeway, what a horse he was, Sam.
Yeah, he was, and there are so many good horses that he's had run at Royal Ascot. Do let us know in the comments who your favourite Aidan O'Brien performance is at Royal Ascot. We'll try and engage with as many comments as possible. Another talking point, I'm going to come straight back to you, Graham, was the draw bias across the week. It was really fascinating to see how that played out. And Simon Crisford had some really strong words to say on this, kind of saying that, you know, owners pay so much money to bring their horses to these big meetings, then you end up finding that it's not a fair track on certain sides of the course. What did you make of the draw bias this week?
It was a little bit unsatisfactory, wasn't it, Sam? Particularly on the first 3 days, although it should be said that it was the same last year on the first 3 days, where they just kept coming up the stand side and everything won up the stand side. And then on the last 2 days last year, the far side seemed to be the place to be. On Friday, the first two winners came from stall one, and I think the third winner came from stall two on the straight track. So it can change as the meeting goes on. Maybe that wasn't quite the case this year. The first 3 days was very strong towards the stand side, and the last 2 days I didn't think it deviated massively from it. Obviously, we saw Baccio flying up that stand side rail for a head in hands moment for me, what are they supposed to do, Sam? And the great thing was this week, Sam, if you watched ITV Racing, so many people came out with my umbrella theory. All they kept saying was, well, there is a big stand, and the stand puts a big shadow over the course, and that causes an issue. I've been saying this for years, haven't I, Sam? The big umbrella that shields the stand side from the rain. When it rains there, it's often suits the stand side rail, and apparently that everyone's taken on this theory now, that the stand is playing a part in why we're getting this bias towards the stand side rail. And in which case, how do you then fix it? You can't take the stand down. It's beautiful there. You're not going to take that away, are you? You can't start messing about with watering in certain places and certain other places. I just think it's just Mother Nature, to a certain extent, has got to play its part. You've got to let it take its course. And if that's the way that it is naturally, it just is naturally going to be slightly quicker up the stand side. There's not a lot that the lads and lasses at Ascot can do to fix it. So there's no real point moaning about it, is there? So I think Michael Owen, was it moaning about it? Mm-hmm. Simon Crisford, you said moaning about it. I don't have a problem with them raising the point, but if you're going to raise the point, then I think you have to come up with an answer as to how you're going to fix it. And that is the nub of the issue. If you don't like it, then you have to have an idea how to fix it. I've got no idea how to fix it. Unless you take that huge stand down, get rid of the umbrella.
this Umbrella Theory, I don't know what you know of Graham's Umbrella Theory. It was about 3 years ago, I was on a show with him, a preview show, and I think it was the Victoria Cup, and it was raining that week, and he was saying that the big stand that goes over the top, it shields the rain, so it's quicker down that near side. And I remember the first seven home in the Victoria Cup were all on the stand side, which the theory paid out. And these mad theories of Graham Robway, sometimes they do work. What did you make of the draw, by?
I mean, the results tell you more winners in the straight course came on that side. But Graham's spot on there. Like, everyone's so quick to blame. I haven't heard one sensible solution. And I was interested in speaking to Chris Stickles on Saturday. I had caught with him and he showed me, they've got moisture detectors all over that course. Mm-hmm. And he showed me the moisture readings, and there was actually more moisture in the far side all week. More moisture in the near side than the far side. So there was less moisture in the far side, which means in theory it should have been quicker. Yet it just didn't play out like that. Again, the round course races are all finished up the far side. It compacts the ground. It should be quicker, but it's not. Like, he set out to make it fair. He takes all his readings. It says it's literally fair. And until the gates crash open, they do not know. And it's the way it's fallen. But if you're going to start criticising, I think you've got to come up with a solution. I just can't see it. And I can't have this idea of trying to even it up during the meeting with water, because if he caused a bigger bias by doing that, like, he would get lynched, wouldn't he? Yeah. So there was a bias. He didn't shy away from that. Finding a solution is incredibly, incredibly hard. And there were certain races, Venetian Sun, Spicy Marg, Indala ran well in the Hunt Cup third, hard up against that rail. A lot of it does come down to pace, and it is self-fulfilling. If jockeys are going to come across, they're going to give up ground, and then you're handing an advantage to the stand side. And equally, where the bigger group is, we see it when cycling, that's where more the pace is going to be. So you've got to factor these things in. There was one, but I don't think it was a scandal some people were trying to make out.
Yeah, there's an awful amount of turf for them to cover at Ascot. I thought the turf was just brilliant all week. It looked amazing. The course looked spectacular, considering how dry it's been as well. One of the stories that was a bit of a shame throughout the week, we were doing a lot of betting ring pieces. I went into the betting ring speaking to bookmakers, and they were kind of saying, despite sales being high, which was great to see at Ascot, they had some, you know, good numbers across the meeting, the betting ring was slightly dead, and a few of the bookmakers were kind of blaming potentially the World Cup being part of that reason. They also blamed the economy and potentially even the price of drinks and fashion for people attending the meeting. I mean, what do we make of the betting ring? How do we bring the betting ring back to where it was? What could be causing those issues?
I think it's a little bit depending on who you spoke to here, because the Star Sports guys obviously had a bad week results-wise, but when you talk to them about turnover, they kind of said, like, business was good all week. There was obviously an issue on Wednesday, but England were playing that night, so that may be a factor. And I've spoken to some of the bookmakers, and they say traditionally Wednesday is a bit of a quiet day. Those second days of festivals can be funny days. But I was talking to Robbie Waterhouse from Australia. He wasn't there, but his pitch, the guys on his pitch, the Aussie lads, were saying they thought business was quite decent all week. Others, as we heard, were saying sort of those £100 bettors there. There was a dearth of them. But I think there's a difference between turnover and results. But obviously, for some bookmakers, turnover was down. And what's that down to? It's hard to put a finger on it. But I went down on the Friday between the sort of precise winning and the in Causeway winning in that gap, and I mean it was rocking. And punters do play up the winnings, and you know there was a real vibe down there. But that'd be unfair for me to say, oh, it was brilliant, because some bookmakers spoke about it. It's a hard one, Sam, to really put your finger on it, but not all bookmakers were saying it was sort of disastrous by any means.
Interesting to hear. Before we go, let's get a highlight from the week at Royal Ascot. Mine was seeing Scandinavia go past. I was so close to the rail on the other side of the track, and it was just magnificent to watch him go past Troll, and I think he's a really, really exciting horse. Lewis, a highlight for you from the week?
Well, boring and say the moment when Ombudsman took off. I just loved his turn. I thought that was brilliant. Also, in sort of interested to see Orthodox and Libertango going forward. I thought they were the future.
Yeah, and the two Wesley Ward runners in that Funchal Beach and Easy Teen. Well, through the years as well, they just took off in that, didn't they? Left it open for Orthodox. And Graham Rubway, your highlight of the week.
Yeah, I enjoyed Ombudsman as well. I think he was the standout performance of the week, and it was something special to be in attendance to see him do that to some real genuine top class horses. But nevertheless, from a personal perspective, probably Blue Bolt winning the race before that, or two races before that. I thought she was very, very good. I saw afterwards Oshie Murphy saying he thought he was unlucky on Friendly Soul. Did he not see how easy Blue Bolt won that race? Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, there were plenty of unlucky performances, weren't there, across the week. But let us know in the comments who your highlight of the week was. We've got plenty of big festivals still to come. We've got the July meeting at Newmarket just a few weeks away. We've then got Glorious Goodwood, which then leads into York. And then we go off to the Ledger and then onto the Arc. There's plenty of flat racing coming up, Lewis.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? High summer's brilliant. Got the July meeting as well at Newmarket. So much to look forward to, and it'd be nice to see these form lines from Ascot if they hold up and things like that. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, really, really good stuff. Plenty of the season still to come. And that's it for this week's episode of The Front Page. Big thanks to Lewis in the studio. Big thanks to Graham Rubway at home for all of his insight to all the winners. And thank you to you for watching and listening to the show. Until next time, we'll see you soon.